Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high and canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, Canada.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you so much, Audrey. Every night I tell you we couldn't do it without you, and we couldn't, and tonight especially, it's a busy desktop and a crowded switchboard, so don't leave me, Audrey, okay? Thank you, Mike and Emily, for being here also, and Mike, yes, that's called 8 o'clock, I'm not kidding you. You've not heard of that? It's a coffee called 8 o'clock. I know it's 9 o'clock, but it's called 8 o'clock. It's pretty good. I'm trying the hazelnut flavor. Try it sometime if you haven't had that. Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network, ladies and gentlemen, and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley. We want to thank Johnny Cash for getting us onto the show tonight and providing us that marvelous introduction that he provides every week for us, where he sings a song that takes him through 90 different cities and states. And yes, he can sing that song from memory. We want to thank the truckers of the United States, too, who bring us better living, and for giving Johnny Cash a ride across all those places. And be careful, truckers. We don't want you to end up on any federal database. You know, we got that serial killer trucker task force or whatever it is going on in Washington now, where they're trying to link truckers to, how many serial killers are there? Our bodies, anyway, in the United States aren't many in a year's time. But anyway, I think that's a little bizarre, but thank you very much. And Emily, thank you for being with us tonight, and again, don't leave us, and we want to thank you for a great job of gathering news tonight, including some audio stories. Ladies and gentlemen, the purpose of our show is to discuss news, issues, and events, developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. We don't need any funny criminal justice stories tonight. The real ones are funny. I'll try to point that out when we get to the news segment of the show, but what we do in the show, we dedicate it to the tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals that serve us throughout the United States and indeed throughout the world. We try to look inside the practice of criminal justice and take a close-up look at its professionals. And tonight, it's going to be a little different kind of show. I probably say that every other week, don't I? But you got to kind of like this probably to enjoy what we're talking tonight. But it's going to be about crime comics. And that is a childhood memory of mine, not having the money to buy them. Well, maybe once in a while, but to walk into the Mitchell's Pharmacy and look at the row of comic books with all those pictures on them. If you want to see some great artwork, I can't show you some tonight, but I'm going to bring some up on the screen and give you some sites where you can do that. But tonight we're going to look at have an interview, pre-played interview with a author Paul Gravatt, who's the author of the book, The Mammoth Book of Best Crime Comics, and it's an incredible buy, something around $18 or $19, might be a little bit over that here in the U.S., but it's a 400-and-some-page book, and I think all of you would enjoy that. And the artwork on some of these is just incredible, and you'll love how they handle male-female kinds of relationships in these books. Some of them are, you know, one of them is just based on women in crime. And so you can see pictures on the covers of these books where a cop chasing a woman in a, you know, in a skirt, tight skirt and high heels, and she turns around and grabs him by the stack and swivel and throws him down. So the artwork on some of these are just absolutely incredible. Well, you're listening on Blog Talk Radio Network, obviously. Some of you might be listening on your phone. I've heard that's been done, and you can. But we want to thank Alan Levy every week for giving us the Blog Talk Radio Network. He's the chief executive officer and the genius behind this marvelous medium where we now have thousands of radio shows each week, and you can start your own show. Any person, any interest group, any organization can have their own show. They can broadcast live, that's what we're doing tonight, in streaming audio over the internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners. Did you hear that? Worldwide streaming audio live, unlimited number of listeners. And what's the cost? It's absolutely free. In fact, it's not only free. If you go commercial, we keep being asked to do that. I somehow don't want to do that at this particular point in time. But if you want to go commercial, you can make money from this. There'll be ads on your website, and as people hit your site and you've got a little more spruced up picture and some graphics and that type of thing, you can share the advertising. I think it's, don't quote me, but I believe it's a 50-50 split. I'm almost certain of that. Is that right, Mike? I think it is. So think about it. You got something to sell, and there are some people on there that don't have anything to sell. I've listened to a few of their shows, but there are some others that are just excellent, and they're on week after week, and a lot of authors, politicians, I mean, on and on and on. Take a look at it. So, as I'm fond of saying, just like that motto on the cheese box, get your own box where you can get your own show. Tonight's show is going to be a little bit different. We'll have our usual segments. We'll do a little bit with Haley on the news, and we're going to have some listener call-ins, perhaps. And we're going to have an interview with Paul Gravatt, who's the author of the Mammoth Book of Best Crime Comics. And I think you'll hear this guy. You'll enjoy his 20-minute response or talk on what makes up these. He is the expert on it, and he's looked at crime comics and the genre since they started. And he'll take you all the way back to Dashiell Hammett, right up into modern times. And very interesting fellow. And you could tell he approaches this field with a lot of enthusiasm, and that's really the. That's the key to any good author, isn't it? They have to sort of get inside of it and like it. Well, what you can do is listen on your media, Windows Media Player on your computer like you're doing. You're welcome to call in the show during the news segment. It's call-in number is 347-996-5983. It's 347-996-5983. We can hold five callers at a time if that many should call. I think next week we're probably going to have that as we talk about doctoral education in criminal justice and other fields, and I'll tell you more about why we're doing that next week. But all in all, these shows can be played back within a matter of minutes. You can download them, save them, take them with you on a MP3 player, whatever you want to do, or never listen to them again. So it's a very interesting option. Well, ladies and gentlemen, as you know, if you've been listening to the show over the last couple of years, that Audrey England is a collector of blonde jokes, and Audrey, again, has a blonde joke tonight. It's kind of an interesting one. This is our closest one I think we've ever gotten to, would you say, Audrey, a risque joke? Yes, but it passed for the general audience. We have no problem with that. So, Audrey, what do you got with our joke tonight?
Professor Haley. Tonight's blonde joke is about higher education and its accommodation for blondes. Why not? They need assistance, right? Hope the audience likes this one. Here it is. The blondes at the university felt like they just didn't fit in. Everywhere on campus they felt ridiculed and were tired of other students assuming they were just stupid bimbos out for sex. They wanted to feel like blondes belonged at the school. A few of them pressured the administration to set up a new department especially for blondes. After much discussion, the university agreed and set up the Blonde Education Department. The blondes were ecstatic. They now have a department of their own, where they could gather without being ridiculed. The blonde college students finally felt like they belonged, and were proud of it. They wanted other students to see that they weren't just stupid bimbos. After all, they now had their own department, the university. They now all proudly wear the official sweatshirt of the Blonde Education Department, which sports the saying "I belong in BED," or shall we say for short, in bed.
Okay, I belong in BED, okay. It's amazing the different kinds of departments that do get established in universities, and some are a little odd, and I would not doubt, I would not bet against someday a department that focuses on blogs, but I could be wrong. We're going to be talking a little bit about that maybe next month on a show where we're going to look again at planet sustainability and its coverage in universities and other places. I think you'll enjoy that one. Ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note, as layoffs continue and crime gets higher, and we're going to have a note about that tonight based on fear, the Ohio Coalition, Gun Coalition, would like you to pay attention to their Ohio Coalition Against Firearms, Against Guns. I'd like you to listen to their public service announcement. And this is directed toward the gangbangers, the criminals, the street thugs who carry firearms. And what the Ohio Coalition would like those people to do is to lay down their guns or go turn them in to the police department. So we hope this public service announcement falls on the right ears.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, it certainly is Ohio Coalition, and we thank you very much for your work on in that field and getting the true criminals in the United States to lay down their guns, particularly here in the state of Ohio. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to jump right into the news here tonight right off. And one of the lead stories here, you know, this is an educational show. That's what we like to think it is. And one of the things that we want to do tonight is we want to make sure that our Director of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, the former governor of the state of Arizona, we want to be sure that she gets educated about something that she's been making a mistake about. And I think you'll enjoy this. The administration wants to stop paying states and communities for jailing illegal aliens with felony convictions. They want to stop that. The Homeland Security Secretary says crossing the border is not a crime. Guess what? She's wrong. So let's go ahead and listen to this this particular clip, and I think you will enjoy this. And this comes on Out Loud Opinion. I don't know if you ever looked at that on there, but there are hundreds and hundreds of podcast news clips every day from fine authors, commentators, etc. And take a listen to this one. It's coming.
Janet Napolitano's Jailhouse Crock, My Investor's Business Daily, read by OutLoudOpinion.com, Monday, May 11th, 2009. The border. The administration wants to stop paying states and communities for jailing illegal aliens with felony convictions. The Homeland Security Secretary says, quote, crossing the border is not a crime, per se, end quote. Oh, but it is. One of the, quote, ornaments, end quote, plucked from the budget tree is the State Criminal Alien Assistance Program, SCAP. In the current budget year, it costs $400 million, making it one of the largest non-defense discretionary items. Its purpose is to help defray the cost for states incarcerating convicts and pre-trial detainees who are illegally in the U.S. It is intended to cover the salaries of guards and correctional officers who hold illegal aliens who are apprehended and found to have at least one felony and two misdemeanor convictions already on their record. The quarrel the Obama administration has with the program is that the money is used for other purposes. Quote, the evidence suggests that the funds are often used in a variety of ways that are tangential to the direct costs associated with imprisoning unauthorized immigrants, end quote, said the Office of Management and Budget Director Peter Orszag. Quote, that may be so, end quote, said Politico's Josh Gerson. Quote, however, the cost of keeping illegal aliens in jail is clearly higher than what the federal government pays. California is getting $118 million through the program this year, but estimates it spends about $1 billion on jailing, quote, undocumented persons, end quote. In what may look like role reversals, President Bush tried several times to kill the program, and Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton supported it as senators. Before he was president, Obama co-sponsored an amendment by his future campaign rival that would have increased funds for the program. Quote, each year the FCAP program is underfunded, end quote, Senator Clinton said in 2006 in support of that bill. She cited a 2005 Government Accountability Office study that found local governments got only 25% of their costs reimbursed through the program. Another Obama cabinet member, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar, then a senator from Colorado, also was a co-sponsor. So why the flip-flop? The administration's current disdain for the program may have less to do with how the funds are spent than with the administration's interest in granting amnesty to those illegal aliens already here. The New York Times in early April reported the administration would draft legislation this year allowing illegal aliens to become citizens. During a recent interview on CNN's State of the Union with John King, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano was asked what she thought about the statement by Sheriff Joe Arpaio of Maricopa County, Arizona, that the Fed should prosecute all caught crossing the border illegally. She responded by blaming employers. Quote, the human traffickers who are exploiting human misery, end quote, and said that, quote, when we find illegal workers, yes, appropriate action, some of which is criminal, most of that is civil, because crossing the border is not a crime per se, it is civil, end quote. With all due respect, and grammatical issues aside, Secretary Napolitano is wrong. In the U.S. Criminal Code, specifically 8 U.S. Code 1325, it says illegal aliens, quote, shall for the first commission of any such offense be fined under Title 18 or imprisoned not more than 6 months or both, and for a subsequent commission of any such offense be fined under Title 18 or imprisoned not more than 2 years or both, end quote. The 2005 GAO study involving 55,322 illegal immigrants incarcerated in federal, state, and local facilities found they'd been arrested an average of 8 times each, with 49% previously convicted of a felony. Imprisonment of illegal alien criminals is expensive and should not be forced onto the states for what is a federal responsibility. Protecting our borders is a national security and law enforcement issue. Illegal entry into America is not jaywalking. It's a crime, something we would think that someone charged with protecting our borders would be aware of. Even for cabinet officials, ignorance of the law is no excuse. Copyright Investor's Business Daily, read by OutLoudOpinion.com. For more podcasts, go to IBDEditorials.com or OutLoudOpinion.com.
Now, you folks there at Investor's Business Daily, you have to be considered here. If you're director of a great big massive department like Homeland Security, you can't know everything. In fact, isn't former governor, current director of Homeland Security, isn't she a lawyer? I don't know, but it is against the law to enter the United States illegally, and illegal immigrant is the term that seemed to describe that, as opposed to simply immigrant alone. Well, ladies and gentlemen, tonight one of the things I've done, I've tied together some prison stories, and I have a purpose behind that. One of the things that happens, you know, when budgets get tight, California, what's their debt at the moment?
Who knows, but a lot of states are operating in the red, and the state of Ohio, from which we broadcast, is also operating in the red. And what happens often, this has happened several times in my criminal justice academic career, when times get tough, they begin to think about letting prisoners out. And the novelty of ideas on what to do with these prisoners and how to sort through the ones that should get out are just incredible. So I've got about three prison stories here tonight, a couple of which I think are going to drop you on the floor. They're outstanding. Let's start with this one. Here in the state of Ohio, if I can pull up this story fairly quick, the state of Ohio, our governor and some folks have decided to do what with prisoners besieged by high medical costs and overcrowding. Ohio prison officials, they're turning to nursing homes to care for inmates who are medically incapacitated or terminally ill. Few prisoners will be placed in nursing homes, perhaps 20 to 40 statewide, says the assistant director of Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction, the only state that keeps rehabilitation in their state agency title, by the way. They're going to have 20 to 40 of these statewide. He says some of these are the most expensive inmates we have. If they're released, as if they are on parole, they will become eligible for Medicaid or Medicare. Peter Van Runkle, head of the group of nursing homeowners, he called the Ohio Healthcare Association. He urged owners, he urged caution in evaluating and screening inmates because of safety concerns and public perception. Now, what do you mean? So your grandfather finally gets to the age where he needs a little assisted living, so he goes to a nursing home, and you're going to worry that he's going to be, you know, in a room or next door to a third or fourth or fifth class felon? Don't worry. I mean, nothing could happen, right? Does this sound a little bit insane? I just don't get it. He says, we serve a lot of different kinds of people, some of them with behavior problems. He said, that's the nature of our business. This is the nursing home spokesperson. He says, but we have to take a lot of care with the people that we admit, I would imagine. He said patients and their families would have nothing to fear because the prisoners essentially would be bedridden. That's what Mr. Randall says from the Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections. He says, I understand their concerns, but the level of incapacitation means that these people are not a threat to the public. If they can move at all, third, fourth, fifth class felons would be a threat to the public, I think. I think they do steal, right? Well, these are people who are in need of 24-hour-a-day skilled nursing care. They're not capable, because of their medical condition, of taking care of themselves or committing a crime. House Bill 130 that took effect March 6 allows prison officials to submit cases of prisoners who meet medical criteria for the Ohio Parole Board. This allows them for possible early parole. The board recommendation must be approved by the governor, Governor Strickland, who worked in our prison system, by the way, as a psychologist. There are numerous exclusions, inmates under sentences of death, oh, that's good, or life without parole, what's that mean? How many of those actually serve life without parole? Those serving time for aggravated murder and first and second degree felons, they won't get it. But you know what happens in the judicial process, I think you probably know, certainly the criminal justice people listening know, that you might have committed a first or second degree felony, but you pleaded guilty to a third or a fourth, first and second being the more serious ones, of course. That leaves nonviolent offenders serving time on third, fourth, and fifth degree felonies and misdemeanors. And if the offender recovers while he's in the nursing home, he's either put on parole, he has to go back in. He says the graying prison population is contributing to the financial stress. While the average age of all inmates is only 35 years of age, one-third of them are 40 years or older, and more than 1,300 are 60 or older. The oldest prisoner in the Ohio prison system is 88 years old, and I assume, I can't assume that, actually, but he's probably in there for murder or some type of serious sex offense.
Randall, the assistant director of the state prison system here, says several nursing home operators across the state have expressed interest in the parole program. State officials will begin contacting judges, prosecutors, crime victims to consider release of some of these prisoners to a nursing home. So what do you think? What do you think of that? Is that a really good idea to you know, send our prisoners to nursing homes right next to your grandfather or whatever? Well, if you think that one's a little strange, let me give you another prison story. This one astounds me because I didn't know it was going on. I had heard about maybe isolated cases, but I think you better hold on to your chair when you listen to this one that was sneaked by us in the news here this past week. Do you know what the federal government does? Listen. Dwayne Keith Fitzen, known as the Shadow to fellow inmates at the federal prison in Waseca, Minnesota, was halfway through his 24-year sentence when prison officials decided to move him to a facility in California. So he's getting moved, transferred. Sometimes trouble prisoners are, well, often trouble prisoners are transferred. Some, in fact, that's court upheld. You can transfer them every 3 or 4 months so that they can establish routines, and set up crime units and all kinds of things inside. To make the transfer, the Bureau of Prisons did something fairly routine for the government agency. It bought Shadow, the crook, a one-way bus ticket and sent him traveling. Excuse me, unsupervised and unmarked on the 2-day trip. Fitzen was 55 at the time. He's a motorcycle gang member convicted of dealing cocaine. He got off the bus in Las Vegas about 400 miles short of his scheduled destination, and he became a fugitive. 5 years later, he's still at large. Now, sit down. Here's the big fact. Since April of 2006, the Bureau of Prisons, Federal Bureau of Prisons, has allowed 89,794 federal inmates to be transferred without escorts, traveling mainly by bus. The rationale behind this unescorted transfer, according to Bureau spokeswoman Tracy Billingsley, is purely economic. Having prison officials or U.S. Marshals in charge of moving inmates who have been pre-screened and deemed low risk would be incredibly expensive. Exactly how much the cost would be, the prison officials don't know. Historically, they say fewer than 1 in 500 inmates have absconded. Although the federal agency doesn't have the exact numbers for recent years, that calculation to more than 180 inmates since 2006. Well, that's all. Bus companies have no idea when inmates are being transferred. Greyhound in particular has asked the federal prison system several times to stop transferring convicts on its fleet. That's without supervision on their fleet. We feel this is an inherent risk to our customers and our employees as well, says Greyhound spokeswoman Abby Wambaugh. Greyhound executive learned of the transfer program in 2005 and complained, and the prison officials tried to appease them, writing a letter noting that of the 77 inmates have escaped during unescorted transfers since 2003, all but 19 were captured. Oh, that's good. Fitzen is the guy, the Shadow, he's one of the 19. Inmates going Greyhound have been gravy for news reporters. It says you stumble upon the subject every few years and attack it with a vengeance. But can you imagine taking your trip across the country on the bus, which I've done probably 3 or 4 times in my life, and sitting next to you, or you could be next to a felon anyway, but this one isn't even out yet. The Bureau of Prisons offers a fact seldom addressed in their reports of the almost 90,000 inmates who've been transferred alone since 2006, 94%. We're being sent to halfway houses. Oh, that makes me feel better. They're going to halfway houses where they're helped to find jobs and integrate back into society. Mm-hmm. And the majority of people in prison at all levels of what? Been in prison before. Have you heard that? That's the truth. So anyway, a very interesting process. I can't believe that. And then on the other side of all this, guess what? Holland is closing prisons. They're going to close 18 of them, I think, or 8. Let me hold on just a second. They're going to close prisons because they don't have enough crime and enough prisoners to fill them. So maybe instead of the Greyhound bus transfer, why don't we send some of our, like Ohio, instead of sending them to nursing homes, why don't we send them to Holland? Maybe that wouldn't be a good idea. If you've ever been to Amsterdam, you have to love a country that puts a house of prostitution at the airport hotel so you don't have to travel downtown while you're on a, layover. They actually did that. They actually have legalized prostitution, of course, and they put a brothel at the Amsterdam airport so people wouldn't have to travel. There's another story that's very interesting about the city of Toledo. Toledo is going through some serious financial problems, and one of the things that's going on is they're laying off police officers. They're going to start with 75, and I don't think that's going to be the end of it. And it says here that when these officers are getting laid off and they're talking about doing it, and I think the action date is coming up pretty soon. It has just been a boom to the firearms business and concealed carry classes. And they interview a woman here in this article about that. And she's the first round of Toledo police layoffs, in which 75 officers were let go. They're already gone, may already be having an effect on gun ownership. I just don't feel safe with the amount they're laying off, says Jonah Ewing. I think it's going to be a longer response time. She's spending the day at a concealed carry class. She's been thinking of getting a gun for a while, but feels now is the time, if any time. I think the leader's probably going to go through, I don't know, I've heard rumors of a couple hundred officers for an agency their size, which is, I'm guessing, 600-800 cops. That's a lot of people. So response time is going to increase, that's for sure. They interview Tom Urbanski. He runs SKEES, Firearms Training Consulting. He also teaches CCW classes, concealed carry. He says for him the layoffs means big business because people are taking safety into their own hands. He said people are panicking. They're figuring the only way they can protect themselves is to protect themselves. My business is booming. Urbanski says that the presidential election and the collapse of the economy, people become more interested in owning guns, and that's been the case all over. A friend of mine said this past week he saw at a gun show a box of 45 caliber ammunition. I think that's 50 shells that normally would sell for, I'm guessing, $25 or $30, go for $185 in the Dallas area. So isn't that just incredible? One more story here I'll just talk about without referring to the details before we get to our interview with the Paul Gavette. interesting. Text messaging. We've got the second national study of this business. And you will just not believe the number of text messages that some of these young people are doing. It says they're spurred by unlimited text messaging plans by AT&T, Verizon Wireless, etc. American teenagers sent and received on average 2,272 text messages per month in the fourth quarter of 2008. Now, I don't know how representative it was, a Nielsen survey, so they do know how to do surveys. But isn't that incredible? So that's like 80 messages a day. That's more than double the average a year earlier. So they're up double. He says the phenomenon is beginning to worry physicians and psychologists who say it's leading to anxiety, distraction in school, I can't imagine that, failing grades, repetitive stress injury, and sleep deprivation. And I've actually seen people standing in a circle, four or five of them, actually calling each other on cell phones and text messaging each other when they were standing next to them. Then they started laughing about it when they figured out themselves what was going on. But now every few minutes, these kids are responding to text late at night. They do it in their bed. They do it in school. He says they can't break free from this. As for peace and quiet, they never know what it is. It's something next to you that's vibrating every couple of minutes. Isn't that incredible? Just absolutely incredible.
They say, well, it's an enormous tool. Sure it is. But, you know, I don't know if I would want my young person to do that. I mean, why do you buy them a phone? I guess because everybody else has one, and then parents are probably lured into the idea that this is better for them. This last one I'm not going to take any time to talk about, but, you know, one of my favorite subjects is planet sustainability. And Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, is in China right now, and she's really going green and talking all over the place about what we need to do, how it's a basic human right that you should live in a clean, sustainable type of planet. But she made a comment that was just absolutely off the wall to me. She said it is a duty that we should do an inventory, a complete inventory of our entire life to see whether or not we are doing the best we can to keep the planet from heating up and being destroyed. And I always say the true believers, we need to check and see. By the way, every picture I saw of her in this article is about four of them. She had on a different $4,000 or $5,000 suit. Have you noticed Nancy Pelosi does dress very nicely? Of course, she's a millionaire, so they can do that. But I say you first, Nancy. You know, if you're not using Wally wipes and a compost toilet and you know, that kind of thing, then I don't think you're serious about your business. Well, enough of the news, ladies and gentlemen. Let's go ahead and talk about Crime Comics. And again, I don't know if any of our listeners have had experience with Crime Comics whatsoever, but some of the most talented people, you know, illustrated books are back. And you've got the manga genre of the, you know, the Japanese books with the pictures and all that business. So pictures are sort of back. I read a wonderful illustrated book of the 9/11 experience. And they're, I mean, it's kind of like put you in there. It's like going to a movie, but it's a book in your hand. They're sort of like glorified comics. But comics had some of the most creative people writing these series. And certainly the artists that drew these pictures, they're just absolutely fascinating. And the book that we're going to hear talked about tonight is Paul Gravett's book, The Best Crime, The Mammoth Book of the Best Crime Comics. It's about a 480-page book, oversized book, of course. They have to be, which you would love for something like this. And it's a collection of 24 mean, moody masterpieces, many painstakingly restored by Peter Stanberry. And we're going to hear, and they cover, let me just tell you about some of the people I talked, Dashiell Hammett and Alex Raymond, Will Eisner, Johnny Craig, Mickey Spillane, Bernie Krigsen, Alan Moore. This is going to be a fascinating thing to read, and I'm going to get my own copy of it. I don't have one yet. I wish I could have done that before the show, but I don't. But these are really something. So let's go ahead and take a listen to this interview about these crime comics, and I think you'll enjoy that. If you've never heard of these kind of things or never experienced the comic book phenomenon, then this will probably be of interest to you. Here we are.
You're listening to Panel Borders. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is an extract from Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. In this podcast, I'm talking to Paul Gravett about the new book he's edited and collated, The Mammoth Book of Best Crime Comics. This follows in the footsteps of Best Horror Comics and Best War Comics. Presumably the publishers approached you saying that we're doing these genre anthologies. Did you particularly want to do crime, or did they suggest you start off with?
Actually, when they first came to me, they wanted to do a mammoth book of manga, in fact, of science fiction manga, and they still want to do that. This is as in real... Sorry, I should say Japanese manga. As you know, what they went off and did is then Best New Manga, which is a fantastic series. It's now in its third volume coming out this year. And in a way, I'm breaking up getting the rights to Japanese material just was probably just too complicated. And I told them this and said, it's maybe down the line, a Best Manga or Best Science Fiction Manga program project will be good. But yeah, crime was partly because it's an interesting area. I'm interested in the genre. I think it's a really rich one. And of course, we're currently really going through a renaissance of the genre, particularly in America. And because I thought the idea of this particular book is to take it outside of the fan world and to sort of have a few names that ring bells to people, like particularly obviously Dashiell Hammett and Mickey Spillane. But yeah, they came to me, and we, to be honest with you, we weren't at that stage. The format was going to be the same as the manga, the Best New Manga, which you know is quite a small format, as are all their regular mammoth books, which are mostly, of course, grey typeset text, and they don't need to be big pages. And we said to them, well, I'm sorry, if we're going to have, you know, European and American comics, we don't want them shrunk down to eye strain size. And we insisted that the format went bigger, and as a result, at that point, they were still doing the war and the horror ones hadn't even been come out at that point. Okay. So they said, okay, well, maybe we'll start the whole line of these things at a bigger size. And that, of course, made a huge improvement, I think. But there was a further improvement, fortunately, when we came to do the book, which is they gave us an extra 10 millimetres, a terribly exciting detail, but extra 10 millimetres width just allows the art book to breathe a little bit more, the proportions of the page. Because that was the misgiving I had, really, about the horror one especially, is that, I mean, they did a fantastic job. Peter did an amazing job selecting the material, sourcing it, but some of the pages were a wee bit too shrunk down on the page. And also were sort of reproduced from the colour comics, and we decided to go as much as possible for black and white.
Because presumably if they were to have colour sections, it would just make prohibitively...
I mean, you saw the first one, the war one, Alex, they had some colour for some public domain material, and there is quite good stuff we could have shown in colour. I mean, especially European people I would like to have had in, but that's for the future. And at the moment, we thought, let's just go for black and white and really emphasise the noir, you know, black and white extremes kind of the graphics.
Well, and the cover in particular, the use of red to offset the black and white, it does seem like you're taking a page from Frank Miller's book.
Well, yes, to be honest with you, that's the artist we wanted in the book that we couldn't get. If anyone asked who we wanted him on the cover. We had cover designs and everything, and we had a story. There's a short Marvin story, I think, which would have worked as a sort of sampler, if you like, for Sin City. But the Miller's people were very protective of the property, and in a way, I mean, with the Sin City movie being so big, you can understand that they wanted to keep the brand specific, and it could have. So, and in a way, I'm very happy to have Burnett on the cover. I think Georgia Burnett and Torpedo. It's one of these books that this series that should be massively popular, as it is across Europe, and it's been sort of forgotten. And I'm hoping, in a way, I know that here at Gosh, they've sold out of all their languishing Torpedo books. Suddenly, people are, oh, this is rather good, and they haven't realised it was how great it is. And there are in Europe, they've just done big compilations of the whole series, and hopefully somebody, some bright American publisher, maybe will reissue them properly now, because they are perfect post Sin City. What do you read next? Read Torpedo. It's one of the very best of its type.
Well, I was going to say, at the risk of giving Gosh a further free advert, upstairs, alongside your book, they've got, you know, if you're just starting to read the crime genre on the basis of this book, why not try the following? And they've got a whole display of various other crime comics that might be a good starting point. I mean, presumably that was part of the point of this collection, that people who don't know an awful lot about the genre can buy this as a sort of compilation and then think, oh, if I like this, then maybe I'll try this next.
Absolutely, because I think people, you know, there's actually only so many Sin City books out there. I think Frank hasn't done any more, has he, more recently? And once you've read them, you'll know what you go to next. So this is the ideal kind of mapping point, sampling of what's out there. And of course, many of these artists directly influenced Frank Miller. I mean, people like Burnett, but also José Muñoz and these kind of artists. And of course, classically, people like Alex Toth and Johnny Craig. I mean, Miller's been on record as just how fantastically influential they were. So in a way, it's the perfect kind of spin-off to the kind of theme that runs through it. Partly is, okay, you've found your way to Miller, we can take you to other places.
I mean, I suppose crime alongside horror were the two big genres in the 50s that were singled out for
was romance, actually, too.
But no, I mean, in terms of the genres that were singled out for being damaging towards kids and therefore gained extra notoriety on the back of it.
Very much,
And looking at the contrast between American and European comics that you have in the book, the 50s was also the time when European directors were looking to America for inspiration, the whole sort of idea of the auteur. And so presumably there was a similar thing in comics as in film in Europe.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, the 50s period, it was really when superhero comics were definitely in the descendant. There was only just about Superman and Batman and one sort of hung on there, the big three, and everything else failed. And as a result, suddenly comics could start to deal with adult issues and, you know, stuff like, I mean, romance was the other big genre. We shouldn't forget romance, horror, and war were the big three. Just generally, the whole human condition could be dealt with in the comics, which hadn't really been dealt with very much if you had to wear your underpants upside your house, your trousers, and fight Hitler and the Japs, etc. And unfortunately, this is a crucial period. In fact, we show in this, but we've got this fantastic Murder, Morphine, and Me story, which is one I'm so glad we got in. It's a classic by Jack Cole. And it includes one of the key panels in the history of American comics, with this injury to the eye image, this woman about to have a syringe plunged into her eyeball. It doesn't actually happen, don't worry, but it is kind of in a kind of surreal world. It's a bit like Chien Andalou and the Buñuel, Salvador Dali surreal film, with the sheep's eyeball being carved up and causing her to do. It caused a similar panic, in a sense, in America in the 50s. Wharton singled it out as an example of the horrors of crime comics. Actually, if you look at the page, it's complicated because it's not, you could say it's not actually happened, because she wakes up, the next panel has her waking up from a nightmare. It's a nightmare, but it's also a nightmare recollection. So in fact, it did happen, in the sense that she was threatened when she was in this terrible drug den in her recent past, and she's having these recurring nightmares. And it actually lent the term injury to the eye has now become a selling point, actually. Actually, if a comic has one of these panels in, or a cover, preferably, but anyway, then it becomes even more collectible.
Well, it seems particularly apt because I'm meeting you just after a visit to the optician.
Exactly.
But it is interesting that there's something about ocular damage that seems particularly censorious when it comes to both film and comics. Because, like you mentioned, in Chien Andalou, and then in the 70s, the 80s, one of the films that was banned under the Video Nasties was Zombie Flesh Eaters by Lucio Fulci, which has a notorious kind of stabbing to the eye by some zombie,
you know.
So there's this reoccurring trope in both media. Another thing that's interesting about the book is the variation in length of the extracts. That like there's an entire issue of Kane in there.
Yeah.
There's a lengthy selection of newspaper strips by
Dashiell Hammett.
Yeah.
We've varied it. I mean, most of the stories are sort of a minimum of about 8 pages. And a maximum of 80 pages, actually. It's an 80-page chunk of... it turns out, to be honest with you, my initials are PD, as in Paul Donald, and my new initials are Public Domain Gravette, because I've just discovered what things are in public domain. Because people don't realise what goes into this, but there's only a certain budget, and I've spent more than the budget, in fact, that I was given, inevitably, because I wanted to make it some of the best. But you have to fill out 480 pages, you have to have a certain amount of material which is free, as in public domain, and no longer owned by somebody. And amazingly, I discovered through Dennis Kitchen, who's a mate of mine at Kitchen Sink Press, I mean, he brought out a big collection of the Hammett, Alex Raymond, as in Flash Gordon, Secret Agent X9 strips, and discovered that they are actually public domain, and neither the Hammett Estate nor King Features own them anymore, which is amazing. And we ran a lot because we discovered that basically after the first substantial story which we included, King Features started to tamper and edit and ruin it. It wasn't as much pure Hammett writing, and there's some great dialogue and great drama in there, even on a daily strip basis from the man himself. And it's the last thing he actually wrote for print. After this point, he was writing only for the movies. And for Hammett sort of fans who are out there, of course, it's probably a bit they don't even know that he ever did. And the other big strip sort of compilation we've got is from Mickey Spillane, who, having come from the pulps and comic books, and when I had a huge success with Mike Hammer in the world of novels, came back to the strip form with this daily and Sunday strip. It's only the Sunday strips he actually wrote, and managed to get. That means remember that the 50s weren't just censorious in comic books, they were censorious in the newspaper strips too. And certainly some of the images, there's one classic panel with a woman tied up, helpless, a captive, and about to have a cigarette stubbed out on her heel. Yes, as you do. And that was not shown just once, it was a climax of one Sunday, then shown again the following Sunday at the beginning of the next sequence, and it caused a huge to-do. It was alongside Blondie and Peanuts, and where things like heel stubbing on women doesn't happen very often, and of course it got the strip censored after that. It didn't appear. So that's a classic again of censorship, also a classic of the crime genre.
I mean, why do you think that crime comics have suddenly become really popular again? I mean, obviously in terms of movie adaptations, there have been things like A History of Violence, The Road to Perdition, Sin City, and now The Spirit, but it seems that the popularity of genres seems to come and go generationally.
Yeah, I don't pretend to be anything like as much of an expert on the film scene. I mean, because I imagine in film, really, it's been there's always been some form of crime yeah. drama on TV, crimes on film. In comics, of course, it hasn't been in America, and this is why the European material is so important, because really, once you get to the sort of 60s, things start to kind of fizzle out, because the superhero is so dominant, and you have to look abroad, you have to look to Europe and elsewhere. And it's there, really, that the genres developed and expanded, became more adult. The same thing happened, frankly, also really with science fiction and with other genres. It was Europe that took the lead there while America got caught up in it. It's a shame because there were attempts to sort of advance the crime genre in America. You had sort of things like Kirby's In the Days of the Mob. You had Gil Kane's His Name is Savage. You had Chandler, not the author, but the detective character by Steranko. And these were all attempts because everyone knew that the crime genre needed all to work. It worked once. It was one of the big, big genres. Why couldn't it work again? But it took a long time. And really, I think one of the breakthroughs which we've got in here is Mystery. Max Allen Collins, being a crime writer himself, also helping and assisting Chester Gould on the all-time classic Dick Tracy newspaper strip. His character is sort of basically, if you like, a Mike Hammer. She's got more balls than Mike Hammer, probably. She's this tough character who, even in this story, which shows where she's 8-9 months pregnant, she still can sort of incapacitate people. She's still a tough sort of private eye, female private eye. And it's a great story, again, but it stands up really well. And that shortly after that, of course, in the first issues of Mystery, in the comic book, you had Frank Miller, who always wanted to do crime. If you look at his early, pre-Marvel comics, when he was doing his own appers and amateur comics, he was doing crime comics. And we know Daredevil and Batman basically happened to have superheroes in, but they were crime, gritty urban stories. And he was doing pin-ups in the early issues of Mystery. And so that Sin City definitely came out of that evolution of crime arriving on the scene. And there's a load of stuff I would like to have got in. We've got sort of, particularly now with writers like Ed Brubaker and David Lapham, I think he's fantastic. And I wrote a fan letter to Stray Bullets, number one. I just thought it was amazing. Just, blimey, amazing stuff. So, yeah, we're in a very, very rich time now. Yeah, and obviously crime writing from people like Brian Michael Bendis and Red Rooker and these other people have really revived a genre in America, which is long overdue. Yeah.
I mean, in terms of the more famous comics creators that are collected in this edition, was it important to you to have, say, an Alan Moore and a Neil Gaiman strip, just so that it not only reaches out to people who read crime fiction, but also people who read comics, since it is the crossover between the two?
Yeah, that was very important. And it just turned out so well that the two Alan Moore stories I knew about that had just been kind of languishing and hadn't been seen in this sort of way worked so well as a kind of top and tail, because you have the light coming on in the cabaret at the beginning, as I'm sure you've noticed, Alex. And at the end, you have the woman walking off into the night after the two. So I think an old gangsters never die. It's a song that Alan composed with David J of Bauhaus, and it was recorded by the Sinister Ducks. But the comic strip itself was only ever produced pretty small, kind of bubblegum card sized, sort of four panels to a page on the size of a single. I mean, really not very well reproduced. And Lloyd Thatcher, I've known ages ago because he was drawing stuff at Pst magazine when I was there in the 80s. And I love he's one of these great artists who, in another world, he would be as big as Bolland or Gibbons. He's just brilliant.
I saw that as I read it. Who is this guy? And where is he?
I'll tell you, the Financial Times.
Oh my God.
Doing, I don't know, he could just design, I think, there. But I mean, he should have been a big name. And it's fortunate he was able to do a fair bit of reworking of the artwork. And so it's never been seen as good as this before. And it just gives a wonderful kind of mood. I mean, I don't expect people to read it from cover to cover, page 1 to 480. But there is a construction. There is a sort of an attempt to create an atmosphere and a whole, to an ensemble to the whole selection. So you come in with this kind of moody, kind of vaguely sort of sleazy cabaret of dead gangsters being having their lives talked to them. And then the last story about Alan, I keep coming back, is one of these ones that's kind of slipped through the net. Many people don't know about it. It was in an anthology, as was the Neil Gaiman, called It's Dark in London, which is a fantastic anthology, a very bold step by Serpent's Tail, literary publisher, who got Oscar Zerati to come in and edit a range of short stories, all based on crime and in London. And some quite big crime writers are involved. I think Ian Sinclair's in there too, and Stella Duffy, people like that. And Neil's story in there is also was really good. And the IT Coming Back is a kind of a coda about from hell with Alan returning to the pub, sort of literally getting inside the character, as in Jack the Ripper, and feeling the same kind of awful, misogynistic, violent, Victorian, murderous presence in our society still there. And the sheer vulnerability of this woman who's doing a striptease act for people in this pub, and how it's the same pub. It's just a very, very chilling atmosphere. And Alan's being very honest about his own, he knows that's in him. If you've gone inside there, that darkness is still lurking in everyone's heart, in a way. And so it ends the book with a kind of, I think, bringing the whole thing up to date, And bringing it up was also harking back to Jack the Ripper, and it's just great to have a Top and Tail Moore story that works like that.
And in both Gaiman and Moore's, the latter two, it's not so much that crimes are being committed, it's the atmosphere of crime and the effect that it has on, you know, the surroundings and the people involved.
Exactly. I mean, to be honest with you, the Neil Gaiman story is sensitive because it deals with homosexuality, it deals with paedophilia and this kind of thing to an extent, because it has one gangster that likes little girls.
Yeah.
And we were sensitive about this to the point where we didn't kind of highlight that in the introduction. We did initially, this is just describe what we know. We thought, no, I think we'll rein this back a bit, we'll take these words out, because the Americans were a little bit sensitive. It doesn't matter if it's in there, and nothing is shown. Nothing is actually particularly erotically shown, but it's if you describe it, if it's in words, they go, oh dear. But yeah, that was part of it, to show different types of crime, different atmospheres of it. And in a sense, I'm going back, and The Court are both very sort of modern or postmodern crime comics.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think one of the great lost graphic novels is Sweeney Todd by Michael Zulli and Neil Gaiman. It's a shame, prologue, and that was it.
Just in Taboo, wasn't it? And you'd have thought someone would have got around to getting that going again. I would have thought Neil must have scripted it out. I don't know.
Mm.
Quite right.
Well, in terms of the effect you might like this compilation to have, a lot of the stuff in there hasn't been printed for years. I mean, you know, it'd be nice to have some new collections of Mystery, the Italian comic that you said is translated for the first time. It'd be nice to have. It's brilliant, you know.
Isn't that wonderful? And that's just a little 10-page. I mean, the main story is a much longer series we couldn't fit in. There's a guy called Gian De Luca. He's one of the geniuses up there with Crapax and Manara and Matotti and all the other fantastic Italians, but never been put into English before. And
I'm going to cut it off there. It's a fascinating book. It's available on Amazon.com, of course, as among other places. And it's a beautiful oversized book. I've seen pictures of some of the pages. But I wanted to mention to you something, a website, if you have any interest in this at all, just to look at the detail that goes into the covers and the thought, creativity, the artistry of some of these books. Go to crimeboss.com, and then take a look at the covers of some of these books, and I think you'll find it absolutely incredible. I'm looking now at the series called Crimes by Women, and that was a comic book series, and some of these covers are incredible, and some of that, of course, they always put some dialogue on the front of the book. And one of these is something like, Louise, I'm going to drill you. But pictures of some of these are just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pictures at crimeboss.com. Click on gallery, and you can see a lot of these pictures and get an idea about how many different crime comics there actually were. And that is just actually a start. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for the night. Next week, if we're collecting our guests right now in terms of the list, it'll be doctoral education in criminal justice and related fields in other fields. And that's always a topic of interest to all kinds of students, particularly graduate students. And we hope that you'll tune in for that segment also. So I'm sure we'll meet again. Good night.
We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing song. We'll meet again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet
Goodbye.